like you mean it, for this is Music Weekly from Guardian.co.uk. I'm Paul McInnes, and before this all comes to an end, we'll get all minimal on your asses with Axel Vilner, aka The Field. We'll have a bumper singles club with new music from Jarvis, Dizzy, and Stuart Murdoch. We'll have the best of your face bang. But first, we'll have one bit of Blur, and that's the Graham Coxon bit.
Sorrow's army bleeds, sorrow's army bleeds. Sees his chest wide open, falls to his knees.
That was Sorrow's Army by Graham Coxon, and he's our first guest this week. Graham is, of course, once again the lead guitarist for Blur after he patched up his differences with Damon and reformed for the band's shows this summer. But he's also been a prolific solo artist too, as Rosie Swash will explain. Hello, Rosie.
Hello, Paul McInnes.
Tell us about all these seven albums that he's been making.
Well, I won't tell you about them all because we haven't got that much time. But started off with The Sky Is Too High in 1998. Part of his thing was he always sounded a little bit like Blur. But his latest album, Spinning Top, it's huge. It's about 15 tracks long. It's produced by Stephen Street of Smith's fame, but also he used to produce Blur. But it doesn't sound that much like anything from the Blur back catalogue or even Coxon's. It's quite remarkable, actually.
That picking pattern that I use quite a lot is pretty much inspired by John Martin, who was taught by David Graham, who inspired me in the first place. So there is a connection. David Graham really was the man for me who was inspiring, because he wasn't a perfectly clean player, and you really heard the guitar groaning and crying under his fingers, etc. It was very strong. The playing was very strong and really groovy and swinging, you know. He kind of was jazz, blues, folk, all kind of mixed in. I knew Davey a little bit because he lived just near me and I'd see him quite a lot. I went to his wake at the Constitution in Camden, and there was lots of really great guitar players there and poets and all sorts. It was a good evening, actually, yeah.
I was quite surprised when I heard this album compared to your last album, which I thought was a bit more punk rock, whereas this one, it's a very beautiful album, but it's I feel very different from the last.
It took me longer to write these because I wrote sort of twice the amount of songs as that are on this album.
There's 15 on there, so you wrote.
Yes, but the others are in another pile. They're more connected to the whining person that people might recognise with the chuggy sort of late 70s guitars. But they're more related to that. They're not quite presented in that way. They're a bit more cheap and machinery-ish. I decided to concentrate on that pile of, you know, if they were going into two piles, let's say, this was the pile on sort of acoustic, more woodeny sound. I was on my own out in Kent in the countryside and just playing, and these songs came very quickly. I'd never written anything in the countryside. I didn't think I could. I thought the city was my place to write. But I did sort of make for some more peaceful music. And In the Morning was written in the countryside at my kitchen table over two or three days. And Perfect Love was written in the country. So all the ones that are a bit more calmer, a bit more pretty, are country ones. And the other ones are a bit more city-ish. So, yeah. Like a piece of the air, it's just how you feel. Are you really there? Are you even real? I don't know which way to go.
I get the sense that you've been quite happy with the way that your career has been post-Blur, partly because you've made a lot of albums, which I imagine you've had creative control over, and partly because, you know, everything that I've read about your days in Blur were marked by you being very resistant to the fame side of things. And here is you getting the best of both worlds. Is that how you feel about the last decade or so?
Maybe. I was a bit of a mard when I was in my 20s. You know, it was a lot of work, and I feel the stress. There was other people in Blur that dealt with it a lot better than me. I can't cope with it quite as easily. I carry all my emotional stuff around with me like a big rucksack. I can't easily just put it down and do stuff. So
I don't know how involved you actually were in Pete Doherty's solo album, but it was the first time that critics who had dismissed him previously said this is a really good body of work. And did you feel a sense of pride at having been involved in...
I did, yeah, but I think also it coincided with a time when Pete's in good nick, you know? And, you know, Stephen's had different sorts of experiences with Pete, as a lot of people have, when there have been difficult experiences and then really great experiences. He came over and he played with some demos, and I really liked the songs anyway. There was definitely four or five straight off that I started to sort of play at home. And, you know, I think he was pretty determined to make a pretty focused and good record himself, you know? He didn't need, you know, nailing to his seat and stuff, particularly. And he did have quite a way to come into the studio as well. It was quite a long, long way he was travelling.
Do you feel empathy with him because he's an addict and it's actually...
Well, I do. I do feel empathy. I don't want to say I know exactly what he's going through, because we all go through individual things, even if they're similar. They seem similar on the outside. I just wanted to support him, really, give him some support.
And by Stephen, you mean Stephen Street, who is...
Streety, yeah.
...produced this album and the last few of your albums, as well as Pete Doherty's and a lot of Blur stuff. Why is he such a great producer?
He's very consistent, which I think is important for me, because I can be in all sorts of... I can't easily control my mood. I'm not an adult like that. That can be sort of professional or whatever. I suppose that I get to the studio in whatever mood I'm in, but Stephen will remain Stephen Street and...
Constant.
And that's a constant, yeah. And so that's very helpful in the studio. And also when I am just flying off erratically to each side, he'll always just bring me to the middle and, you know, with some of my ideas that... So, you know, he's pretty good because he's always there doing that sort of thing.
How do you feel about the impending summer of the Blur reunion? Are you excited?
I am quite excited. I'm quite excited about... What came into my head was the rider and whether we were going to get, like, and we were going to get bits of cucumber and carrots and all that sort of stuff. And in my head, it's going to be beautiful and sunny, and sunset will happen at a particular moment during the set, and we're all going to be smiling and the faces are going to be happy and jubilant in the audience. It's going to be fantastic. But, you know... You know, it might rain.
Some musicians, they want to put a distance between their past work, particularly if they're very young when they're involved in their first couple of albums. They don't feel proud of it. They don't want to, you know, associate with it. Or it's very painful for them to go back to some of that material. Is there any of that which you're worried about going back to the Blur songs?
Not really. A lot of them are emotionally charged. And actually, there's one or two that are personally, kind of do have a weird personal thing. And us being men, we didn't... Yeah, you know, we're emotional sorts, but we were doing a couple of songs in the rehearsal yesterday and not quite having eye contact. It was really weird. Yeah, it's interesting.
What, too close to the bone?
Yeah, just kind of like, I'm going to play this, but I don't know whether I can really look at them while I'm playing this.
Well, you can look at the audience when you play them. Yeah. That's okay.
It's just odd. There's some songs that have come to sort of symbolise a certain thing of the relationship within the group, you know, however complicated and insane that has always been, there's still these songs. It's kind of embarrassing because people will see us playing one or two of these songs as some sort of healing process. You know, they'll see it in that kind of way. I'm sure they will. And in a way, it kind of is that we're going to do Out of Time or something from Think Tank, or we're going to do Batch in Your Leg, which is the last thing I played on. And I know that this might mean a lot to fans that we are playing that together, and we are aware of that. And so it makes us a bit squirmy about it. And a bit weird. So it's kind of like... But, I didn't think that they really wanted to play those songs until I said, look, I think we should. Because I think it would just be nice for the audience to see that there was a kind of a strange chapter within the Blur story that, you know, that we've got past, and we're into a new, happier one. And I think it's important to illustrate it for fan people. Thank you.
is one of those songs that stands for a very important part in Blair's history, country house, because in interviews that I've read with you, in interviews I've read with you, that seemed to be a bit of a turning point for you in the band.
It was a bit of a turning point. It was getting a little bit too clever and a little bit too celebrity mate-ish and a little bit into celebi world a bit. You know, and much as I have a lot of respect for Damien Hirst and Keith Allen and all these people that I met when I was sometimes out with Alex, I'm not sure that it was a great idea to get all mixed up on a project together. You know, what I thought was a really good and clever song. The lyrics were extremely good to Country House, turned into a farce. Mm. And I didn't think it was taken seriously enough. And I thought it's gone into the realms of the Baron Knights. I thought it was a shame. And that definitely made me start to go slowly mad. And Damon, I think that, you know, Damon was a bit mad at the time too.
Did you really make up with Damon over tea, over high tea?
No. When has it ever? No, Eccles cakes.
Eccles, right.
Mornington Crescent.
And did you really not have a relationship at all until that point? Because I mean, you go back really longer than anyone else in the band. You started off as friends.
We didn't, but it wasn't as if we weren't. It's like, no, not talking to him. You know, it wasn't like that. It's just that he was so busy, I was so busy, and the years just flicked by. You know, it was just like that. It wasn't because we really were against the idea. But there was so much pressure and rumours going around that we were going to do something together that I thought I'd better talk to him. I'd warmed to the idea anyway, and I thought, well, I'll meet with Damon and see where his mind is on it all, because he's always so busy. I thought he probably hadn't really given it much thought. And even so, there was a lot I wanted to say to him about what had been going on or not going on in the few years before that point. Before we even get anywhere to talking about BLUR, there's stuff that me and him perhaps just had to say to each other, and it was pretty nerve-wracking. But it was absolutely fine. In some way, it became obvious, and we didn't quite know how to deal with it, but it had become obvious that we needed to go our separate ways for a bit. But we didn't really know how to tell each other that. You know, we didn't want to hurt each other's feelings or let it be known that we've kind of had to give up on the thing or whatever, because it wasn't as strong as that. It was just, I think we needed some time apart. And then when we met up and we had a cup of coffee and some Eccles cakes, whatever like that, and it became apparent that all the stuff that had been built up wasn't actually there. It was just spectral nonsense. And it was like, oh, okay, we're all right then, aren't we? And it was like, yeah. But we did need to have some time to do other things, definitely, because it would have gone wrong eventually. The wheels would have fallen off.
Are you really getting back together, or is everyone going to abandon?
We're doing some shows, and we're going to see how that goes. That's it, really. But if we're all happy, zingy friends, I am not against the idea of carrying on and doing some other bits and bobs if everyone digs the idea. But, you know, I don't want to look that far into the future. There's just too much going on this spring and summer.
Given all the various members of Blur and what they've been up to in your own solo careers, is that going to extend back to a reimagining of the Blur songs?
No, I don't reckon. I think you have to respect that a lot of the music you make is sort of public property, really, after you've allowed it to be released, especially for so many years, and it's become part of people's lives and their history, and it's sort of a nostalgia. I quite like them the old way we played them, and if we do fiddle about with them, it won't be on purpose. I think it's probably just because we've forgotten what we're doing momentarily, and if they're any longer, it's just because we didn't come in on time on certain things.
Sorrow's army die, sorrow's army. Sorrow's army dies, sees his wife at home and feels his body cry.
That was Graham Coxon, and The Spinning Top will be out on Transgressive Records on May 11th.
Cry havoc and let slip the frogs of war, for it be time for Singles Club. And who better to join us for this first ever all-naked, greased-up wrestle version of our review feature? Oh yes, it's Will Dean of The Guide.
Hello, Paul. That is my speciality.
Oh, well, good. I'm glad, because I see you've come in your in a white dressing gown and nothing else, so you seem to be prepared. Anything going on in the world of popular culture that you might be able to tell us about through your work with the guide?
I've been watching a new show called Sons of Anarchy, which comes out on Bravo soon.
Sons of Anarchy?
It's a biker version of Hamlet from the guy who did The Shield. And it's all right, but I'm going to give it a few more episodes, but that's one to watch out for.
I'm certainly quite intrigued by the prospect of that. Good. Move on, Paul. This is our first track this week. It's Jarvis Cocker with Angela.
Angela, Angela, an infinite symphony. Angela, 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 she's mobile poetry. Angela, and she's nearly 23, making 4.50 an hour, complimentary shower. They call her Angela, Angela, oh Angela, Angela.
That's Angela by Jarvis Cocker. Jarvis Cocker is a national treasure, alongside David Attenborough, Alan Bennett and Susan Boyle. He is also so tall that he can look over the top of buildings and, as a result, is believed to have Britain's largest collection of lost footballs. Rosie, this is the first track from his upcoming album, No.
No, yes.
No.
Yes, it is. Yes, I think is called Further Connection or something extremely dull like that. I love Jarvis Cocker. He is, of course, a national treasure. Fell in love with him when I was in my teens and I loved pulp. And this song, it kind of made me want to laugh, you know, especially the Adam and the Ant style. Angela. Other than that, it's brilliant. And, you know, he can get away with doing that stuff 100%. And, it's also got its very stomping, glam, Bowie influence as well, which, you know, he's definitely one of the musicians who's been influenced by Bowie through his whole career in a brilliant way. I just think it's an infectious little song from a, you know, very interesting solo artist now.
I agree. It really, really makes me smile.
Yeah.
It really rocks out. Does he often rock out?
No, I don't think if you heard this, especially in the beginning and you didn't know who it was, you wouldn't think, oh yeah, this is a new Jarvis Cocker song. Maybe it's a layered vocals or something.
Two other influences, I would say, The Kinks.
Yeah.
And also in the vocals, Elvis Costello.
Mm.
Any more influences, Wildeen?
It reminded me a little bit of the Von Bondi.
Yes.
Not quite.
That's
as
good.
Yeah.
The full set.
Like you talk about him being a national treasure, I think I preferred the actual concept of Jarvis and his being than actually listening to his records, even though I quite enjoyed the last one. And I don't know if you guys watched it on the website, but you can play a video of him arranging letters of his name while the song plays, and I found myself being more interested in that than the actual track.
Oh, but really?
Which, you know, I liked it. It was quite cheeky and quite good fun, but...
I found the arranging of the letters exactly what the side of the dark side of Jarvis. I don't like the conceptual Parisian dwelling artist side of Jarvis. Although, oh God, please stop arranging these letters. I know you're going to spell your name. Just cut to the chase. I found the lyrics quite interesting. Mm. I thought in that kind of Ray Davies-y way, the kind of the making 4.15 an hour, complimentary shower. Is that sort of social observation? Is that one of his specialities, Jarvis?
I don't think it's necessarily one of his specialities in his solo work, but it's definitely one of the things that Pulp, he did brilliantly during Pulp. Here it's a bit more sort of about the wordplay, obviously, than the meaning behind it. But, you know, who knows who this Angela was and who inspired it, but it's definitely part of his inspiration.
And is there anything at all creepy about a 40-something-year-old man perving lyrically about a 23-year-old?
Not necessarily pervy, is it? Appreciative.
I'm just asking the questions. Angela by Jarvis Cocker is available to download from jarviscocker, or one word, .net now. Second track on Singles Club is Bonkers by Dizzy Rascal.
Some people think I'm bonkers, but I just think I'm free. And I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me. Some people pay for thrills, but I get mine for free. Man, I'm just living my life, there's nothing crazy about me.
Bonkers.
Oh, it's all tunes that make you laugh this week. That's Dizzy Rascal with Bonkers. Ever since they first met on Newsnight last November, Dizzy Rascal and Jeremy Paxman have become best mates. They go raving in Stratford together and apparently are working on a joint history of the Reformation, which surprised me, certainly. This is my choice. I've been wanting to do this for a couple of weeks. In fact, I kind of had to deflect Casper Llewellyn Smith of doing it last week on the dodgy grounds that it wasn't available on the internet for our listeners to hear. But now it is, because it's on the BBC website and obviously been ripped off in umpteen places. And I'm sure it's going to be one of the biggest tunes of the year. Why? Because it's both silly and it's crazy. And that's kind of why I love it. I love the fact that Dizzy has, inverted commas, sold out. I like the fact he's making music that is fun and will appeal to lots of people. This tune is made with our man Van Helden, who around our desk when he was put up for an interview about 6 months ago, we all dismissed as a has-been. And this tune takes the kind of klaxon, house bass and our man's old beat, but it still sounds fresh and it patently doesn't care whether it sounds fresh or not. It is wild, it is bonkers. And if it's the tune that makes a 23-year-old black man from Bow our biggest pop star, then I'm perfectly happy with that turn of events. Will?
Well, I did think it was rubbish, and I still thought of think it's rubbish, but having just seen you dance to it while we're listening to it there, I'm sort of changing my mind. My notes just say in big letters, put a bonk on it.
Yes, man. So, yeah.
That's my review in five words. I agree. I don't think the fact, you know, the idea that he's sold out is particularly bad. I really like Dance With Me, the Calvin Harris collaboration. But with that, it sounded like their two sounds combining. And, you know, it was a great, fun pop record. And that's why it got to number one. Whereas here, it sounds like a little bit of a Dizzy song, which then turns into a ridiculous Armin Van Helden song, punctuated only by someone going bonkers.
Which is presumably Armand himself. I love that kind of like thick American trying to get a hold of bonkers.
It's like a kind of cut and shunt song rather than a proper collaboration.
Interesting.
So that is why I'm not putting a bonk on it.
Interesting. Rosie, what do you think?
The first opening bars, I thought, oh, God, because it's just like tuning into Dave Pearce. Oh no. And then it totally changes, and oh, they must have done that on purpose. When you're listening to it, you're kind of going, okay, and you don't know what's going to come next, and that kind of grips you. And I think you're right. I think it is going to be something that people really go for. I don't care, you know, I'm like you, I don't care about him selling out goods, you know. I mean, who can go on listening to the same grime record over and over again for the rest of your life?
Yeah, I mean, I think Will's probably got a point, although I think it is the type of dance music that can have a cut and shunt approach applied to it quite readily without you noticing that the joins all that much, because it's quite simple music. I think there's something so appropriate about this track and the lyrics, given the point in time that Dizzy's at, given the point in his career, that he writes these lyrics that are one saying, I don't care what you say about me, people think I'm an idiot, but I don't care. At the same time, doing it with such abandon that I think really marks him out as being a smart, canny artist who knows very well what he's doing. And that the video bears that out as well. There's some great scenes in the video.
He's soft, isn't he?
Yeah, it looks like a Hype Williams kind of thing. He's dressed in baby gear, and then he's got a shark's head on, and then he's got some kind of new rave fluorescent shit going on too. Oh, I'm just all for it, and I could listen. I have already listened to it about 200 times, and I could listen to it
bonkers.
I am, man. I'm going to put a bonk on it. Right, that is Bonkers by Dizzy Rascal. It's out on May the 18th on Dirty Stank Records. But you can watch the video now at the Zane Lowe Radio 1 page, amongst other places. Our final tune this week is Come Monday Night by God Help the Girl.
Come Monday night, the day of work is done. Tuesday morning looms, the grey of ordinariness. Start by putting off your chores and all the crushing bores. Say your morning prayer, sing a rousing.
Has God Help the Girl with Come Monday Night. Rupert Murdoch still hasn't forgiven his son Stuart for creating Belle and Sebastian instead of taking a job editing the business pages of The Sun. That said, there does appear to be the prospect of a rapprochement as Rupert plays backing tambourine on this, the first track from Stuart's new group, which features Catherine Ireton as his appointed vocalist. Will?
Yeah, I chose this, one, because I'm a very big Belle and Sebastian fan, and two, because I think the concept of the album is quite interesting. I think it came from Stuart Murdoch being a bit sick of writing songs as Belle and Sebastian songs and had a few put aside. He says it's a musical story, so it's kind of like a musical, but without the stage show. It's just a record. And it's a bit strange to hear this out of context. I mean, I've listened to the whole record and I think it's brilliant. But hearing it now, just especially after listening to Bonkers.
Everything seems like a downer after Bonkers.
It sounds a bit soft, and I don't want to say twee, because that's an easy thing to throw at Stuart Murdoch when I think he's brilliant. I like the fact that he's not gone back and done another Belle and Sebastian record. And he's also used, on the album, he uses Funny Little Frog and Act of the Apostles songs from The Life Pursuit and re-records them with the girls that he's got to sing on this album. And I think they're actually much better. So, yeah, you know, I think it's good.
Musically, how does this differ from Belle and Sebastian output for you?
I don't think it's 1,000 miles away. I think there's more of an element of those kind of 60s girl groups and 80s sort of indie in there, which you know, is probably in Belle and Sebastian as well. But I think to take his voice out of most of the record, he just auditioned these three girls as kind of like an indie idol and got them in to sing these songs that he'd written. I don't think it's miles away, and I think it would never going to be, being Stuart Murdoch, and probably going to only be bought by Belle and Sebastian fans.
Rosie, how does it grab you, if indeed it grabs you and doesn't come up and politely shake you by the hand?
I don't like it. And I really like Belle and Sebastian, and I don't like it for the reasons that it differs from the Belle and Sebastian back catalogue, in that I have to reuse the word twee. For me, what Belle and Sebastian had that so few other bands were able to nail was such a like darkness there, a sort of sinister angst that this, for me, completely lacks. There was some really dark lyrics. I think there was Easier Feet Into the Sea was about suicide. It really felt like a sort of a cloud of depression hung over it. So it balanced out some of the lighter melodic stuff that was going on. This reminded me a bit of like maybe Dusty's, maybe more the Carpenters in a weird way. And for that kind of almost maniacal Stepford Wives type, everything's great, we're just walking along singing, which I just can't bear.
It made me think of one of those bits in a French New Wave movie where there's some kind of artificial moment of jollity, gaiety going on, and they're kind of skipping through the streets and something nice is happening, but you know in about 10 minutes somebody's going to get shot or there's going to be a huge moment of existential outpouring. You can download Come Monday Night at godhelpthegirl.com, and their debut album is out in June, we believe. Will, you're well ahead of the curve. We're going to give you a little bit of face back from the old blogger on last week's tunes. Rama Lucian said, "The Dirty Projector single was pretty good. I quite like the jingle jangle over the top, reminding me of Strawberry Swing by Coldplay, dare I say."
SV80 said, "Paul's right about the Kelly Clarkson version of Since You've Been Gone. The Robin and Kerry Hilson versions are nice enough, but the original carries a surprising emotional punch. The Ashraf song is enjoyable in a kitschy sort of way. I tend to have mixed feelings about reissues in the vein of Sound of Wonder and the recent Nigeria 70 compilation. It's great that these hidden gems are being uncovered, but it arguably taps into the idea of foreign pop music as best enjoyed 30 years after it had been made, with a slight ironic detachment and presented via archive-hunting Western DJs. Be nice if we didn't have to wait until 2040 to start appreciating some of the amazing stuff being made around the world now."
It's a great point by SV80, but I think I do think it's an interesting one, and one that would probably bear further argument, because I wonder whether there's all that many people who are ready to appreciate that sort of music when it first comes out, and whether it doesn't take a period of time to get accustomed to it. Anyway, any more thoughts on that subject, please do post them on the blog, as well as your reviews of this week's tracks, God Help the Girl, Dizzy Rascal and Jarvis Cocker, on the blog at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. Tell us what you think of that, and also what you think of this.
Tread me in the carpet like a piece of dirt. If the words fail, then you just floor me.
Professor Headlock.
Living. When will I learn that you're no good for me?
Ironic, Tiny Dancer.
To know how you go to, so hold me closer and don't let go. I'm falling, so please just don't let go.
Hold me closer, I'm trying to dance.
Hold me closer, just hold me closer.
The Maccabees, Love You Better.
Tell me right now, you really want to spend your whole life alone?
Kanye West, Paranoid.
Might do what's good for, we be done for good. Cause I can make it good, I can make it hood, I can make it come, I can make it go.
And that's it for this week's Singles Club. Next up, we head to Berlin, or in truth, a car park in Shoreditch, to meet The Field.
Hey.
That's The Field, aka Axel Vilner. Originally from Stockholm, now based in Berlin and recording for Definitive Techno label Compact, who are based in Cologne, Axel is basically more European than any other act we've ever had on the show. His 2007 album, From Here We Go Sublime, was something of an ambient minimal masterpiece. You can probably say the same thing for Axel's English, as I was about to find out when I met him in London recently ahead of his second similarly sleepy album, Yesterday and Today. What would you say is the abiding mood of the album?
I think it's pretty hopeful, in a way. Some kind of good feelings in there. Yeah. More than the last one, I think.
And why is that?
I think I was in a better mood. Also, the whole approach of recording the album was so different and fun in a different way. So, and I think you can really tell the live feeling to it and all that stuff, that it's more hopeful and fun.
This live instrumentation and element,
yeah.
You can hear some live instrumentation in the final recordings, but not so much.
Yeah, no.
Did you work it in the sessions and then take it out again and replace it with programmed elements?
No, it's more or less the other way around. It's programmed elements from the beginning and then more or less transformed into live recordings, more or less, or additions, and also these layers of things. So it's not vice versa. It's,
right.
Yeah.
What instruments in particular were you bringing in?
A lot of analog keyboards and stuff, but even live drums and live baritone guitar, live bass, glockenspiel, vibraphone, all of that stuff.
And is that something you've worked with much in the past, that kind of instrumentation?
Not really, since I have my roots in punk rock. So,
so the glockenspiel doesn't figure much?
It doesn't really crash. Glockenspiel, doesn't work. It's super sounding instrument, so I wanted to use it.
You work with John Stainier of Battles.
Yeah.
What's your relationship with that band? Are you a big fan of Battles?
Yeah, of course. They're very good, and I think I met them the first time in Brazil, and we had a gig together, and we hung out the whole night, and it was a really good time, and then we kept on. Every time we met somewhere, we played. Then I met John in Köln a lot, and we just decided to make some music together.
So with regards to Yesterday and Today, people are talking a lot about krautrock and krauty elements. What do you take that adjective to mean, krautrock?
The repetitive, minimal changes, also kind of the instrumentation, what you use. But
so coming back again to that idea of what makes good dance music,
yeah,
and something
sure.
that kind of builds and repeats and shifts.
More or less the same kind of structure, really, in the music. It's mostly about how you do it and the instrumentation and what you use.
I'd like to ask you about Everybody's Got to Learn Sometime. Okay. So this is a track that some people might know as an 80s pop tune by the Corgis.
Yeah.
A lot of people in the UK will know it in various different rave versions,
Baby
like Baby D. Exactly. What attracted you to this track?
First of all, it's from my youth. Also, it's a really, really good song, of course. And yeah, the whole thing happened so spontaneous. It was no pre-production there at all. It was really in the moment, and we were having dinner at this house where we recorded, and it came on the playlist, and we said, why not just do something out of this? And we did, mostly for fun in the beginning, but then we liked it, what we were doing, so we decided to just record it. I loved the idea to take more or less the basic element of that song away. That's probably it, and it sounded really good to do it like that too. We also tried a little bit with the whole hook and everything, but it didn't really suit me, so
because it's almost like the ideas that are left in the song, or the ideas that make the song, are original, your original compositions, and they exist, they kind of seem to spark off the original hook. So it's almost like you can feel the processes of you listening to that song and then working
for it. Yeah. And that's also like the effects of what it does when you don't have it there, in a way. But it's, and that's good.
That's Axel Vilner, and he's The Field, and Yesterday and Today is out on May the 18th. Deep breath. Have you composed yourself? Good. It's time for the feature with no name now. It's Rebecca Nicholson on Veruca Salt.
I heard of Veruca Salt when a school friend brought a cassette of their debut album, American Thighs, back from a holiday in the States. Though grunge already had a firm grip on my peers, we all had army satchels with the Nirvana smiley face scrawled on in marker pen. Veruca Salt's style was only lightly kissed by grunge, bringing harmonies and huge choruses to the indie rock landscape. Their first single, Seether, came out in 1994, and it brought them to the attention of Courtney Love, who took the band out on tour with Hole. It took Courtney another 4 years to release her own heavily pop-influenced rock record in the shape of Celebrity Skin. If you search YouTube for Veruca Salt Glastonbury, you'll see the crowd go crazy for Seether as the pair play off each other's rock star moves. Album, Eight Arms to Hold You, followed in 1998, but this is more polished and less charming, and despite producing a small hit with Volcano Girls, it quickly sank into obscurity. This may have been why Louise Post and Nina Gordon, who'd carried the first record with such a best friends for life girl gang attitude, fell out. Gordon left a year later to pursue a moderately successful career as a singer-songwriter, though her best-known solo work remains an unlikely cover of NWA's Straight Outta Compton. The real reasons behind the split have never been discussed. Both remain tight-lipped, but that only adds to the intrigue. Sadly, Post continues to record and tour as Veruca Salt, putting out two further albums with a revolving cast of musicians, though neither have been particularly successful. But it's with American Thighs that the band's reputation begins, and that's where it really should end.
That is Rebecca Nicholson, and that music was Veruca Salt, and that was also the feature with no name, which will return in due course next week. Rosie, fancy hitting us up with some brief face backage.
Jimmy 2000 wrote, Paul, what possessed you to give the Hours this type of coverage on the podcast? Okay, I know that they're giving away a big expensive painting, and this will generate a lot of hits for the Guardian website, but you have to draw the line somewhere.
That's kind of fair, I reckon, Jimmy 2000. Obviously, I didn't have any say in the matter. Also, producer Ian, while having previous opinions about the Hours, did change them in a positive way when he heard the album, so there is something to be said for that. It's been reasonably well reviewed. Music ended that bad, but you're right, it was kind of all tied into the OMM's big giveaway of the painting, and in actual fact we don't even get any of the web traffic. Okay, post comments on this week's blog tell us what you made of Graham Coxon, The Field, and anything else we may or may not have discussed at guardian.co.uk/musicweekly. That, however, is it for this week. I'd like to say thanks to Will Dean. I'd like to say thanks to Rosie Swash.
You're very welcome.
And we'll all see you next week. Until then, bye-bye.